Hey folks, in this episode, I'm sitting down with Chris Gampet. We're going to be talking about third-party lenses.
This is Twit.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of This Week in Photo, another one-on-one chat for you guys. Today, I'm sitting down with the photographer himself, Mr. Chris Gampet. He's the guy behind that famous blog. But we're going to be talking about specifically third-party lenses. Are they worth it? Are you giving something up? Or should you just stick with the OEM manufacturer lenses when you start building out your kit? So welcome to the show, Chris. How's it going, man?
I'm all right, man. How are you?
I'm doing good. You nice and cozy over there in New York City?
Oh, yeah. Quite a bit of snow. But in my 30s, I decided that I would make my apartment more comfortable by burning candles around it. So there are nice candles here burning and keeping me warm.
Nice. Yeah, we got quite a bit of things burning here in California, too. But not
really?
Not
I had
candles.
No idea.
Not candles. So that's a whole other show entirely right there, man. Well, cool. Before we dive into the lens discussion, I just wanted to get an idea and sort of introduce you to the TWIP audience. So just give us your 30-second elevator speech. Who is Chris Gampet? What is the photographer, you know, website? Why'd you build it and all that stuff? And then we'll dive right in.
Cool. My name's Chris Gampet. I'm the editor-in-chief of the photographer. We founded the site around 9 years ago because I wanted a different kind of space in the photo world. I wanted to, instead of looking at all those lab tests and stuff like that for reviews, I wanted something to be more personable. Like, for example, I don't see a wedding photographer pitching to a bride these photos of her and then her looking at her pores 100% in the photo. And same with, like, let's say your kid getting their school pictures done. No one's going to sit there and be like, wow, my kid's eyelashes look really good. Look, those speculars on their skin. Like, no one's going to do that.
Yeah.
No. So I wanted to create something more practical. And that's what I did. And that evolved more into, the psychology of photography. And, 9 years later, I am on TWIP. So there's
Look at that. That's awesome, man. Well, it's an honor to have you on TWIP. So, well, you know, this is sort of the mutual admiration society that's going on. And we refer to your site all the time. And it is, for the folks that haven't been there, the one or two people that haven't been there yet, it is a invaluable resource. And you know, just kudos from one sort of online content creator to another. It's admirable how you are egalitarian in your reviews and very fair in the things you write. And people can go there and know that they're not getting sort of, okay, at the bottom, you know, here's a sales pitch or anything. You're very honest with everything you do. So congratulations on that. And thanks for creating that thing.
Yeah, man. I've always believed honesty is the best policy, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, it is. It shows through on the site, too. So let's dive into the topic that you and I decided we're going to cover in this interview, and that's the idea or the I don't want to say it's controversy. There's always controversy in the photography world. There's always this versus that. But I want to talk about the idea of third-party lenses versus OEM or manufacturer lenses. So, and I'll set it up. So from my perspective, the school of thought, or at least let's say my school of thought is get the manufacturer lenses. You can't go wrong with those because they're fine-tuned to work with the camera bodies that, you know, that they're being attached to. But that said, I know that, and that's coming from a knowing place of ignorance, because I haven't tried third-party lenses yet for fear of, like, well, if I'm going to buy that lens, maybe I'll just buy the OEM one and wait a couple of weeks and pay more. So where do you fall in on that? Is one better than the other? What are the trade-offs?
If this were pre-2012, I would have agreed with you. But in 2012, that was around the time where Japanese manufacturers and a bunch of others had a bunch of problems with the factories. If you remember, it was partially because of earthquakes and tsunamis going on over there.
Yep.
And I remember that year during, was that a Photokina year? Photokina and Photo Plus, that was the year where all of the third-party manufacturers really started to step up their game. You know, Sigma for years had pretty paltry lenses. And then after a while, they announced this global vision program, and suddenly, like, all their stuff was great. There weren't that many autofocus problems with the cameras and the lenses anymore. They were sharper. They were more affordable. And in some cases, they were actually even better built. So these days, you know, it really depends on the system that you're going for, because one, I think that different systems have different levels of support depending on how long they've been around and just what's sort of out there. Like, for example, Sony, when they launched the FE camera system, that's like the A7, all their full frame mirrorless cameras. They decided to be very, very open about working with other manufacturers. So Sigma now works with them. Tamron has a couple of lenses for them. Rokinon doesn't really work directly with manufacturers. They just sort of figure stuff out and then they put stuff together. And then Zeiss, they started working with pretty much immediately. So out of the gate, you know, they have all that. Whereas, for example, if you look at Fujifilm, there aren't really a lot of major third-party lenses for them from other brands. Like, Sigma hasn't made anything yet. Tamron hasn't made anything yet. But there are good lenses from Rokinon out there that are available for the system. And then there are other Chinese brands that have been popping up that are actually pretty good. Like, Seven Artisans, for example, is one brand. So I want to say that it really depends on the system that you're going for, whether you're going for APS-C, Micro Four Thirds, or full frame, or even in this case, medium format these days. And then it also depends on what your needs are. So, for example, do you go shooting in the rain pretty often, you personally? You guys don't.
Not if I can help it. But yeah, my cameras are weather sealed, but you know, I don't choose to test that per se. But
right, not like I test it. I understand.
Yeah, exactly.
So I really like shooting in the rain. It's one of the things that actually sort of exhilarates me. Like, I'll go outside and I'm like, man, this is a physical challenge. Let's do it.
Nice.
So I'll actually take my cameras and I'll be like, you know, this is pretty cool. I live in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And what's really cool is, you know, all those bodegas, they have neon signs. So when the neon signs are up and, you know, it's darker like it is outside right now, and then there's rain on the ground, there are all these reflections that sort of bleed into one another, and you can make them look like paintings really easily. I'm actually working on a project about this. It's a long-term project. It's one of my two projects that I want to put out next year.
Beautiful.
But thank you. It can help you create in a completely different way, and that's what I feel like photography is really all about. You know, you're trying to either understand the world around you in a different way, or you're trying to express something. And the act of taking a photo usually has some sort of intention before it. One of my favorite things to actually do is walk around Brooklyn. I live in Williamsburg, and when it's raining, you know, the bodegas and some of the establishments like restaurants and stuff like that, they have neon signs outside. So when you have the image of darkness and then those neon signs and then the water kind of spilling onto the road because of the rain, you get these really cool reflections that come off of the road, and they look really gorgeous overall. You look at the whole landscape and there are these neon signs reflecting off of the road because of the water.
Yeah.
So because of that, I need weather-sealed lenses and weather-sealed cameras. But, you know, not everyone necessarily wants to do that. I have friends who they're saying, oh, I'm going to Iceland. What camera should I get? And I'm like, well, do you actually plan on using this in the rain? They're like, maybe not. So I'm like, okay, well, this is something that you can get instead. So it really depends on your needs. And I think part of those is budget. Part of those is the quality that you really feel you need versus what you want.
Yep.
Whether or not you need autofocus for what you're doing, and then the type of stuff that you're shooting.
Well,
so
with those though, like you bring up weather sealing, which I think for a lot of people is critical. You know, when I think about the engineering and the sort of the fine tuning that goes into these precision mechanical and optical instruments, I think, can a third party really make a piece of glass that I can put on my really expensive camera body, and will it be, quote, weather sealed? Some people say weather sealing is impossible. You know, there's weather resistance, but you know, if it's a third party, like from a consumer perspective, I guess where I'm going is from a consumer perspective, if I'm like you and I'm like, you know, I like to shoot in the rain all the time, I want to make sure I've taken every precaution so that if I do get caught in the rain and my camera gets drenched, it's going to be okay. If I, you know, say, okay, I can save $100 or $300 by buying a third party lens, is that going to compromise the integrity of the weather sealing that the manufacturer intended? What do you think about that?
That's a little difficult to say because, in sort of private talks that I've had with a bunch of these manufacturer reps, they all abide and they all publish SEPA ratings, which, basically, more or less, it's the equivalent of you, let's say, taking the camera or the lens and then dunking it in water very quickly and then pulling it back out and make sure it still works. Mm-hmm. But for example, phones and other products, they're not really rated on the same scale. And as you know, like my iPhone, it's rated to be waterproof for a little bit, and I can use it all the time in the rain.
For sure.
With third-party lenses, in our testing with, let's say, Tamron, some of Rokinon, some of what Sigma makes, anything they say is, you know, weather resistant, there really are seals that are built into the product that really do ensure that, you know, water doesn't get in or dust doesn't get in or something like that. Mm-hmm. And with certain OEM products, they can be better weather sealed. For example, Olympus products, to my knowledge, when talking about them with other manufacturers, they've actually said they've been nearly submersible in terms of build quality.
Wow.
Which, I haven't tested myself. I mean,
yeah, that's an expensive test, right?
Yeah. One of the tests that we did was we took the Olympus OMD EM1 Mark II, mm-hmm. and we ran it under a faucet for 10 minutes. And it was using one of the OEM lenses. And with that faucet test, it was still able to keep functioning even as the water was going on it.
Wow.
So that's pretty fantastic. I'm not sure that if you got a third-party manufacturer lens and put that out on there, that would happen.
Yeah. And I wonder if you did get caught and what that does to your warranty, right? So if I have a third-party lens on there and I'm out shooting, I get caught in water and it wasn't 100% weather sealed and something happened or there was some sort of water damage and they knew, you know, that, hey, you were using a non-OEM lens, does that void my warranty for any sort of repair or you know, or any sort of standing that I have to get my gear back in working order? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so that isn't necessarily something that would be covered by an OEM manufacturer under a manufacturer's warranty, but you can get that covered with a retailer or with a third-party retailer, third-party warranty. I'm sorry. One of the things that I haven't purchased in a while was a Mac repair warranty. I used to buy them. These days, I don't do it because I just have insurance mm-hmm. on all my gear. So, you know, just the insurance covers it. But in terms of that type of stuff, you might want to buy a warranty that does cover that kind of stuff and will take care of any sort of problems involved with that. And you can buy them for like 1 year or 2 years or what have you. It really depends.
Yeah.
But I've never really heard of anyone getting a problem where actually no, that is completely false. I have there's this one situation where I heard of where someone was using a Canon 5D Mark II years ago in a very heavy rainfall in the rainforest, and they were using it with a Sigma lens, and the camera sort of stopped working, and the manufacturer back then, I think it was Canon Professional Services, they were saying, oh, well, you know, like, this isn't really necessarily covered, you're gonna have to pay a little bit of money. And I mean, the professional, you know, he needed to do it anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think things have probably changed, but either way, I mean, it also depends on what you're doing with it.
Yeah. I wonder about simplicity and just sort of, you know, like, you're in the field or you're traveling in some, you know, a foreign country, and, you know, you got your gear with you and something happens. you know, I know, like with CPS, can or NPS, you know, one of those services, you can say, hey, my whatever broke, send me another one or fix it, whatever, and they're on it, right? They'll take care of it. But I wonder, and I know, I'm assuming that there are third party sort of warranties like that, where if my third party lens malfunctions or something, I send it to them and they'll fix it. But what I'm trying to reconcile is it worth it? Like the savings that you save from getting a lower price third party lens, all things being equal, let's say the image quality is the same and durability, all that's the same. But the money that you save on a third party lens, do you lose that money by having to sort of split your efforts when getting repairs? Okay, my camera has to go off over here, then my lens has to go off over there, and I gotta have two separate, you know, threads of conversations going versus, hey, CPS or MPS, fix my stuff and or send me new stuff. What do you say to that?
So in a lot of the tests that we've done, let me reference something specific. So like a Sony A7R2 or 3 camera that's pretty well weather sealed, or a Sony A9, we've used them with third party lenses from Zeiss, which are said to be very, very well weather sealed. Zeiss even goes as far as even using the language weather sealed in a lot of their marketing. Sony uses splash resistant, moisture resistant, dust resistant, all that stuff. When I've taken those products out into the rain, I haven't had any sort of problems with my products. So in terms of practicality, you're probably okay in most situations as long as you use common sense in a way. Like, you don't sit there and you're like, oh, well, I'm deciding that, you know, I've never swam in the Gowanus Canal. I want to go swim in the Gowanus Canal right now and, you know, check out what's underneath, and I want to bring the Sony camera along. If you're going to be an idiot like that, then, you know, I don't want to say you're asking for it, but that's not going to protect you.
Right. Yeah. Use common sense, right?
Yeah, exactly. If you know, like, you're outside, you're using the stuff, and you start to see problems where, like, the camera is failing a little bit or the lens is failing a little bit, then obviously, you know, after a while, kind of take cover and, you know, wipe it off, give it some time, or just stop shooting at that point. Go outside, use your phone instead if you have a smartphone that's weather sealed. And then later on, you know, let it dry out. If it's still not working, maybe put it in a bowl of rice for 24 hours and it should be okay. Yeah. That's not really a reason to, you know, necessarily involve the manufacturer.
But is that the main compromise? We've been talking about sort of weather sealing and that ilk of problem. But is the, like, when people are watching this and you found this on Google or whatever, and they're trying to make the decision on, should I stick with OEM or should I go with a lower priced third-party lens? I know things have changed. Like you said, things have changed over time in terms of the build quality and all that. What's the main compromise that they're giving up? You know, if you take warranty out of it, weather sealing out of it, are they giving anything up? Or are third-party lenses sharper than OEM lenses? Like, what's the trade-off here?
If you look at a bunch of lab tests, the sharpest lenses out there are made by Zeiss, Sigma, and Sony. Mm-hmm. Zeiss makes lenses for everyone else. They don't really have their own cameras. Sigma has their own cameras, but respectfully, no one really pays attention to them. they make a lot of fantastic lenses for other formats, though. And, you know, when you look at it in comparison to a lot of what Nikon does, they're basically blowing Nikon out of the water. So you get better image quality. What can happen is... the autofocus algorithms can sort of fail after a while, and that's not due to build quality. That's due to the manufacturers actually changing algorithms on the camera via firmware updates or something like that. So what usually happens is, in the case of Sigma, they try to offer you this dock, and you know, you put the dock, you connect it to your computer, you put the lens on the dock, and then you update the firmware on the lens so that it can work better with the newer cameras. And I mean, that's one problem. But for example, with Canon, if you put third-party lenses on their cameras, Canon will have like this peripheral correction thing built in, so you have to turn it off, or else you're going to get a bunch of rings around the entire image.
Interesting.
If they're not first party lenses. For other manufacturers, it really sort of depends. I mean, with Fujifilm, in most cases, you're giving up autofocus. But if you don't need autofocus, let's say you're shooting landscapes or you're shooting portraits, focus peaking will work just fine.
Yeah.
And you'll get great image quality. You're probably going to give up weather sealing, but that's not really a problem. For Micro Four Thirds, you know, they have each other in a way. They have Olympus and Panasonic. They both make weather sealed products. My favorite lenses otherwise are made by Voigtlander for them, and Voigtlander doesn't have any weather sealing at all.
Yeah.
So you're giving that up.
And yeah, with the, on the Voigtlander side, you're giving that up, but depending on the lens, you're getting insane speeds, you know, of their glass, right?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. So, I mean, you're giving up autofocus, but, you know, if you really want that bokeh or you really want that extra light sucking ability, then, you know, you're going to go for that. It doesn't really matter. If you need weather sealing, then you're probably going to go with a more expensive Olympus or Panasonic option that's out there.
Yeah.
So, again, I mean, I feel like the manufacturers, they've had a lot of years to sort of recover and to reposition themselves and make themselves more profitable. So they're looking at all of these situations that are trying to find ways to make their products even better. I mean, I feel like years ago, there were probably some terrible product designers and they were like, I have the idea for a product and it's going to be pretty terrible. And their manager was like, yeah, and I can make it even more terrible and we're going to sell the crap out of it. Yeah. That doesn't happen anymore.
Well, some software companies that still happens, but yeah.
Well, yes, I completely agree with you when it comes to software. But in terms of hardware, the internet is a much different place. A lot of us tend to hold manufacturers to their claims.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, no one's really making bad products anymore. It's really just about what you want and what you need. And there's always going to be compromises, I feel, in some way.
Yeah. When it comes to making that decision, though, the what you need decision, what are best practices? Should people, you know, maybe rent, you know, go rent the lenses that you're thinking of getting, you know, or maybe rent a lens from an OEM lens and a third party lens and try them both out and then make a purchase decision, or, you know, read reviews on your site or other sites to kind of get their brain around it. What's the flow that someone that's sitting there with, you know, a couple grand to buy lenses with and they're trying to figure out how to spread it around? What should they do first?
Well, first off, I think they should be completely 100% honest with themselves. I feel like that involves you knowing who you are photographically and your photographic identity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, a question that I always ask my dad, because my dad, he owns a Canon, I think he owns a 70 Mark II. And he was like, I want something else. And I'm like, well, Dad, do you really need an interchangeable lens camera? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, well, do you actually change the lenses out? Because believe it or not, most people, they buy a kit lens and they never take it off.
Yeah.
And my dad, he's like, no, I actually really do. So I'm like, okay, well, let me figure out what you're doing. He lives in Georgia. And every now and then, he used to be an economist at the United Nations. And he's retired. And every now and then, he still does like freelance work for them. So he'll have to travel like Asia or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in some parts of like India, they'll have really, really big dust storms. So when you take the 70 Mark II out to a place like that and they have dust storms and, you know, you want to go out and he's bringing his camera around him with him, he needs something that's going to be able to resist all of the dust that's being hit, thrown at him.
Yeah.
So he needs something that's a little higher grade when it comes to build quality. Maybe something with a little bit of weather sealing. And then he prefers zoom lenses. He's not really a prime lens guy. Mm-hmm. He needs to be able to just stand in one place, just take a photo of something, and then zoom in whenever he wants to.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, you know, he can probably spend a little less money, but still get something that's pretty weather sealed when it comes to getting products from, let's say, Tamron or Sigma, because there are options like that. From Canon, though, you're usually going for L-glass, and he doesn't really necessarily need L-glass, let's be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really about, one, understanding who you are as a photographer and what you're using the camera for. And then after that, it comes with identifying what your needs are. And then from that, you then look up zoom lenses for Canon or zoom lenses for Nikon or something like that. And you can type that into Google. And my background is in SEO. So, I mean, we're basically all over those searches. Google changed algorithms a couple months ago, and I really pride the work that we've done because we're usually like number two or three in any search.
That's cool.
Cool.
Yeah. What about Zoom though, Chris? So part of the conventional wisdom, and I'll say old school wisdom, was that Zoom lenses will never, ever be as sharp as a prime. Is that still true? Or it's still true?
Yes, that is still true. Okay. I think that the reason why, and I mean, I used to argue with my old manager at B&H Photo about this a while ago. I was like, you know, like they're putting all this work into one lens and one focal length and making it the best they could. And he's like, for sales reasons, he's like, yeah, but they're doing the same thing with the L glass. I'm like, okay, but there's more that can possibly go wrong.
Yeah.
And when you sit there and look at lab tests, a lot of those prime lenses are still out doing a lot of the zoom lenses. But zoom lenses aren't bad these days. I mean, they're still very good. I still feel that, like, if you have a prime lens and a zoom lens and you put them right next to each other and you use a flash to get the most details out of the images, the prime lens will do better, but most people won't really necessarily be able to tell the difference when you look at the whole image. And I think that the whole image is really what's most important.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap this up. I want to get your thoughts on, or actually I want to put you on the hot seat and find out what Chris is shooting with. So what's in your bag? What's the photographer's gear kit of choice these days?
Okay. Do we got like 10 minutes more?
Okay. Is your bag that big, man?
So I have... Jeez. All right, let me start this off. First off, when it comes to bags, we get tons of bags in for review all the time, and more than any other website, I think we review the most bags. I'm right next to me. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 camera bags that I'm reviewing right now.
Oh, wow.
And each of those have different kits in them. So Sony is used for most of my photojournalistic work. When I say photojournalistic, I mean most of the work that needs to be done for Photographer. Mm-hmm. So I have a Sony A7 R3 with an A7. I have an 85-1.8, a 35-2.8, and a 55-1.8 because they're small and they're all weather sealed and they're all effective and reliable. And then I have...
Those are Sony lenses, right?
Yes, they are. That's okay. Correct. Okay. I have Adorama Flashpoint little flashes, and then I also have Godox flashes for that system. Mm-hmm. And that system of flashes, I have triggers for Canon and Fujifilm because I also own digital in those formats and camera brands. Mm-hmm. And they can trigger the flashes, and they can communicate TTL with those as well, too. Fujifilm is what I use for a lot of my more sort of documentary, like, close work. Mm-hmm. I have an X-T2 and I have an X-Pro 1. The X-Pro 1, I think, is still one of the most beautiful digital cameras ever made. The image quality just looks like film and, you know, makes my jaw drop every time I take images with it.
I hear that from people that own that camera. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a 16-1.4, which is weather-sealed, the only weather-sealed lens I have for Fujifilm. And then I have a 23-1.4, which my copy editor is borrowing and I need to get it back from him. And I have a 35-1.4. That was my first lens. But other than that, I recently picked up a Canon EOS R with a 51-2 because of the fact that I really like what it does for portraiture. When you look at a bunch of other manufacturers, I feel that there's a lot of over-sharpening with their algorithms and their processing. But with Canon, it's like, man, that skin looks sweet. It's perfect. Like, even with flash, like, I don't really need to retouch or spend a lot of time in post. It's beautiful right into the camera.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy with that. But personally, honestly, I shoot a hell of a lot of film.
Really? You're back to, so I've been hearing that a lot from a lot of people, that they're sort of going back to the future or back to the past, as it were, and shooting film. Why film? You like, you know, the process of it, or you like to slow down, or what's the romantic side of it?
Believe it or not, so I'm actually legally blind. Really? So yeah, I'm legally blind. When I take my glasses off, I was explaining this to someone in yoga today. The way that she was positioned in the room, it looked like she was a Cyclops because of a shadow that was literally underneath her, like the area underneath the eyebrows, sort of merging the eyebrows and the eyes into one. So as I got closer to her, I was finally able to see, oh, you have two eyes. You're not a Cyclops.
Wow.
The way I see the world is much different, and it's sort of like a painting. But for me with film, it puts more of that emphasis on, you know, I need to train myself to really work with the subject more and to get a different look. And I don't necessarily care about looking at the images immediately because I have a very good feeling. I know what I'm getting because I'm putting so much work into it beforehand.
Yeah.
So I own two Leicas, an M4P and a CL, and a couple lenses. And then medium format. I also own those film cameras, by the way, because we actually still test a lot of film. There are new film emulsions that are coming out every day. Actually, I'm sorry, not every day. Maybe like every quarter or something like that.
Yeah.
So we test those. In order for me to test those, I need to have a couple cameras around.
So film is not dead then? So
film is not dead. It's actually doing fairly well in terms of the smaller brands. So I have two point-and-shoots. I have two Leicas, and I have three medium-format cameras. I have a Fujifilm GW690, those Texas Leicas.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Mamiya 6 with two lenses that I got for a stupidly cheap deal. And I still have a Mamiya RB67 with a couple of
I love
bats.
That camera. I love that camera. That's what I used to shoot with. I used to shoot with a Mamiya, the RB67, and then the RZ. Remember the RZ came out as well?
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love those cameras. It's just like you get, especially on the film side, you get into that sort of, it's almost like ballet when you're loading film because you're like, this goes here, click, click, you know, all that.
Yep.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like that puts you more in touch with the whole process of taking photos and looking at your camera and working with it and not necessarily like, you know, looking and chimping your LCD screen or something like that. But yeah. Another reason why I also really like film is because I feel like it's a pretty good investment piece. Like, for example, the Contax T2. We worked on a story and published a story a couple months ago about how that's now the most expensive point-and-shoot in the world.
Wow.
There are people selling it for starting at $1,200. Sometimes it goes up to $2,000. And I don't know a single point-and-shoot that is really over that. There are a couple, actually, no, by Sony and Leica. But that's really about it.
Yeah.
And I mean, film to me, it's just sort of romantic. I like being able to shoot and just worry about the images later. And if I need something immediately, my phone does a good enough job. So sometimes I'll do that.
Are you fully committed to film though, Chris? Are you shooting, processing, and printing your images? Or are you shooting and then sending it off and getting it scanned and then bringing it into Capture One or Lightroom?
I usually, for testing, I will shoot, get them processed at a lab not too far away from me,
mm-hmm.
get them scanned, bring those in, and sometimes I'll print them. I have a Canon ProGraph 1000, and I use a lot of Epson Legacy paper,
cool.
which is like their highest end stuff. So, in terms of testing, I'll usually just do the scans. In terms of printing, printing is actually a really big part for us when it comes to high ISO testing for cameras, because everything looks good on a screen. But when you print the image at like 17 by 22, it's a whole different story.
Yeah.
So, for example, when we were testing Kodak P3200 T-Max, which came back out, I was making really big prints with it because I really wanted to see what it would look like.
Mm-hmm.
Not darkroom prints, but they were from scans.
Yeah.
Darkroom prints, I don't know a single lab that really does darkroom prints
right.
here.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, okay, so here's a final question. And I don't even know if you can answer this question considering what you do every day, right? But and considering your depth of knowledge about these different cameras and lenses and all that. So I preface it with that you may not be able to answer this. But your desert island camera lens, do you have one? Right. A lot of people say, "Oh yeah, yeah, it's this with a 51.4, and you know I can survive with that." If you had to pick one from all those cameras that you have and live with it, let's say for a year, and that's the only thing you could shoot with, do you have one that you'd gravitate towards?
I'm on a desert island. Do I have connection to electricity?
Or well, yes. Well, let's rephrase that. You're not on it. You're still in Brooklyn, but you're only allowed to shoot with one camera and one lens for an entire year. Which one would you choose? See, that's hard, isn't it?
I think that I would probably go with my Fujifilm X-T2. Wow. And the reason why... Wait, one lens?
One lens.
Yeah, you know what? I think... No. I would probably... Yeah, you know what? Let me say this. I think I would actually go with the new Canon EOS R and the 50 1.2. And the reason why is because I was thinking about that just now, and Sony has quite a bit of good weather sealing built into it. Mm-hmm. But when I sit there and I look at Sony with the size, that's fantastic. But when I look at Canon and the size, you know, I'm getting an f1.2 versus an f1.8, and I'm getting arguably what I feel is better weather sealing. I'm not getting as good of a product when it comes to the camera, but the camera is good enough in this situation. I think the lens is more important.
Yeah.
So the reason why I'm going with the Canon EOS R is because of the lens. And I should probably... let everyone know that Canon is a sponsor of the website right now. So is Fujifilm, so is Epson, so is Mu. They're buying a lot of ads with us right now, but that's not influencing my decision. When it comes to lenses, I genuinely think that Canon is probably doing the best right now in terms of the mirrorless wars. In terms of camera bodies, it's probably Sony and Fujifilm. And in terms of ergonomics, it's Fujifilm and Olympus. You can't beat them.
See, that says a lot. It says a lot. I love the sounds of New York coming from your side over there. It's awesome. I feel like Spider-Man's right outside your window swinging around right now.
Yeah, man. It's crazy. You know, the other day I was woken up at 1 a.m. because someone decided to just set off fireworks. And
at
I was
1
like,
a.m. Nice.
At 1 a.m., literally right behind my apartment. I'm like, are you kidding me right now? And then suddenly, like, 20 people ended up calling up the cops. And you heard basically the same sirens, except 20 tenfold.
Oh, jeez.
Like, all around.
Wow. Well, you know, it's crazy all over. Chris Gambit, thank you for doing this, man. We've been trying to do this interview for a long time. And, in fact, even during this interview, the universe has been conspiring to stop it for some reason. But we got it done. It's going to get edited and it's going to get published very soon. So I appreciate you coming on. And, again, congratulations on all your successes with the Foblographer website. And, by the way, I had to practice before we got on this call saying that name. My mouth does not want to say Foblographer, so I had to train it to say it.
Good, yeah. Because that means eventually you will get it right.
And I will.
Of my intention that I had when starting the website, so yeah.
That is so cool. Yeah. All right, man. Well, cool. Any final thoughts you want to leave with the This Week in Photo audience and, you know, or direct them to any specific place?
I'd say follow us on Instagram. We are at Foblographer, Phoblographer. And go to our website, thefoblographer.com. We publish on Monday through Thursday, we publish 7 times at a minimum each day. On Friday, we publish 4 times, on Sunday, 4 times, and on Saturday, we publish twice. So if you didn't read us for the entire weekend and then you came back on a Monday, you'd be like, oh crap, there's just a lot of content.
Jeez,
so, yeah.
That is a whole nother interview to talk about how you, and I'm serious, I want to talk about how you manage that empire of content production. That is, that's amazing. So I take it you know your way around, you know, you can type pretty fast because that's a lot of content. And you got a staff of writers as well too, right?
Yeah, 2 of us are based in Manila, 2 of us are based in London, 3 of us are here in New York, and 1 of us is in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So every time zone, every major time zone at least. And I wake up accordingly to be able to cater to everyone.
I love it. Well, cool, man. Well, thanks again. And This Week in Photo, folks, make sure you check out Chris's website. I'll link to his Instagram and the website, obviously, in the in the show notes, you know, and the description on YouTube, so you can check it out. Well, cool, man. All right, go enjoy the rest of your day in hipster New York while we hang out here and you know, try to survive in California.
So. Stay safe, man. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, man. Take care. See you.
All right, bye-bye.
This is Twitter.